Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening, depending on where you are. I'm Barbara Peterson, the Poison Pen in Scottsdale, and delighted to be talking today to Sarah Stewart Taylor in her new book, A Stolen Child, which is another chapter in the evolution of Maggie Darcy, who's a really interesting character, and has finally not only moved to Ireland and settled in with a new family, but managed to complete training in the Irish Garda so that she can continue her police work, because her Long Island credentials didn't really make it through Ireland, right?
That's right. She had to do some retraining in order to work in Ireland.
Right. So it's not that easy to pronounce the name of the Irish police force. What is it? Is it the Siobhan Garda?
It's a Garda Síochána, which translates as Guardians of the Peace.
Guardians Síochána. Okay.
Garda Síochána.
Got it. And how are they? Are they different? I mean, are they a national police? Are they sort of like Scotland Yard?
Yes. So it's a national police force. So all over the Republic of Ireland, and they have divisional stations where, you know, sort of different regions of the country are administered. Different functions are administered from those offices. But it's a national police force, and they have a Bureau of Criminal Investigation, which is sort of not exactly like our FBI, but it's the sort of nationwide, you know, when there are major crimes, the Bureau would provide assistance to the local divisional detectives. And that's where Maggie is hoping to end up within that division.
Got it. But right now she's in Dublin. So joining us today is Lisa Holstein. Hi, Lisa. And her cat.
Yes.
What's the name of the cat?
Josh.
Okay. Well, anyway.
He's from a humane society, and he came with the name Schroeder. And I was, he didn't seem like a Schroeder to me.
Schroeder the cat. Isn't that a character in something?
Charlie Brown, right? Isn't
isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Yes. So the piano player in Charlie Brown, yes.
Right. Anyway, Lisa, as we're fortunate, is the blogger for The Poison Pen and a distinguished librarian and critic who writes mystery reviews for various journals. And so we're delighted to have her. And she wrote a really glowing review of this book. So I thought, not in her capacity for The Poison Pen, but in her other professional capacities. So I thought, wow, would it be great if she were to talk to Sarah and give you a new perspective. I would just say that I am a big fan of this series, and I do think that it's helpful to read it as Sarah has written it, because there's a lot of personal development in the characters and so forth, and changes in their lives that you can plunge into this one, and it's a complete crime investigation, but you might be somewhat confused. Plus, it does spoil the suspense of earlier books if you find out what decisions the characters make, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I always hope that people can read them as standalones, but I would always, of course, encourage people to go back to the beginning and, you know, really get the whole arc of Maggie's development.
Right. So signed copies have just arrived from Sarah at the store today, and we have a handful left. So let me encourage you to order one while you can. And otherwise, Lisa, I'm going to sit back and let you pepper us with questions.
Okay. Well, I have questions as to what Sarah has been doing during the month of June. But because Barbara brought it up, I do want to ask, first of all, about the story arc. Did you start the first book, and do you have an ongoing story arc that you're planning? Did you know that when you started the series?
It's a great question. So I wrote The Mountains Wild as a standalone. It was a story I'd been wanting to tell for a long, long time, and I wrote the book and I wrote the last page, and I thought that was it. I thought I had told the story. And it wasn't until we sold it and I was talking to my editor at Minotaur, and she said, you know, what do you think? Do you think you could make this into a series? And I think at first it felt like I'd said what I wanted to say about Maggie. And I think I even, you know, hung up the phone, and immediately the wheels in my mind started turning. And, you know, of course, the first thing I went to was that at the end of the first book, there's a love story that is left somewhat undecided. And so that was kind of an obvious place to begin. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that I really, as funny as this sounds, I really admired Maggie as an investigator. And I wanted to see how she did with other cases. I wanted to see what she did in other circumstances. And so it was sort of the little seed that my editor planted about making it into a series really, you know, really started to grow quickly. And, you know, and I started to think about how I could get her back to Ireland and what some of these other cases would be. I have an arc in mind for her, you know, and it's always tricky with series because you want to have kind of a short-term arc that will feel satisfying, you know, depending on how many more books you get to write, but you also want to have a long-term arc in case you get to write a lot more. And so I sort of have two tracks where there are some storylines I think I could wrap up in a few books, and I have many more things that I would love to explore in her life over quite a lot of books. So we'll see.
So talking about Maggie, she started out in Long Island.
That's right.
Did you ever have any intention about writing more of her in Long Island?
I do actually, because there are some she has some unfinished business on Long Island. And so in my mind, she is not done with one case in particular yet. And she's not done with her personal history on Long Island. You know, her personal history on Long Island is traumatic and dark. And there, you know, I think it would be too easy for her to just, you know, she's making her life in Ireland now. That's where she'll be. But I think it would be too easy for her to just sort of move on and never return to any of that history that she has on Long Island. And her beloved Uncle Danny, who owns the bar, is still there. And, you know, he's getting older. And I think she's going to have to be checking up on him a bit. And the series will mostly be in Ireland, but I envision some forays back across the Atlantic.
The Mountains Wild felt like it was a passionate love story about Ireland. And that's why I wondered if it was going to be long, when I read the first one, if it was going to be Long Island or Ireland. And I read all four of them, as Barbara always says, in real time. would you talk a little bit, for those who haven't met Maggie and haven't met the series, as to what you can tell us about her without revealing spoilers in the course of the series?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, Maggie, as a series character, Maggie came from some really deep thinking that I did about the families of people who have disappeared. I was just fascinated by this idea of, if you had a loved one who went missing and you never got answers, there was never any closure, there was never any solution, how would that change the course of your life? How would that affect everything that you decided to do afterwards? And so Maggie, at the beginning of The Mountains Wild, she's a recent college graduate and she's working at Uncle Danny's Irish Bar in Long Island. And her beloved cousin goes missing in Ireland. And she, for a variety of reasons, has to sort of step up and be the family representative and go over there and try to see if she can figure out where her cousin went. And she can't, she doesn't. There really are no good leads. And she returns home, and she and Uncle Danny for 23 years, you know, just every morning wake up thinking this could be the day we get an answer, and then disappointed. And, you know, as I say, 23 years after Aaron's disappearance, new evidence is found, and Maggie, who's now become a homicide detective, goes back to Ireland to see if she can solve the case once and for all. And I won't spoil it by telling you how or whether she solves Aaron's case, but I will say that, you know, I really love the idea of exploring a character who had become a homicide detective because of her cousin's disappearance. You know, Maggie is not someone who, she would not have become an investigator if her cousin hadn't disappeared. She probably would have been an English professor or something. And I just love that idea of someone whose course of her life was changed by this disappearance, and everything that happened afterwards to her is in some ways hinges on this terrible tragedy. And so, you know, once I knew that I was going to write a series, I initially was going to just send her right to Ireland. The second book was going to be Maggie in Ireland working as a detective. And as I started working on it, I had this realization that she wouldn't just leave her job. She wouldn't just quit her job for a man. She wouldn't do it. It's not who she is. And so the second book in the series, A Distant Grave, was kind of my exploration of what would have to happen for Maggie to quit her job and to move to Ireland, and the case that she gets involved with, which is a very dangerous case with political ramifications and, you know, wide-ranging effects on everyone around her, sort of is the only thing, to my mind, that would make her leave her work and move to Ireland. And then in the third book, she and her boyfriend are kind of trying to see if they can create a family. And that's really what the book's about. They're renting a house for the summer and, you know, trying to blend their families and trying to see if they can make it work. And the fourth book, it's not too much of a spoiler to say that she's in Dublin and she's working, finally, she's working as a guard. She's not a detective yet, but she's on her way. She's putting in her time, community policing, wearing a uniform, when she gets the case that is at the center of a stolen child.
Before I ask about the Portobello neighborhood, I'm going to ask about your characters. It's understood that major characters will continue on with Maggie, family members, the police officer in Ireland, her friend Raleigh. I can say that because that's not giving anything away. Right. But what about the few minor characters? Why does an author pick out a minor character from one book to continue into the next book? Because you have a couple police officers that continue from one book to another that were minor at one point.
Yeah, it's such a great question. And, you know, I think part of it is sometimes expediency, right? That you need, you know, you need a character to do something in the book. And something that often happens to me is I'll kind of invent a character just because, you know, someone needs to hand her the paper or something. And then as I write about them and think about them, I like them and I want to know more about them. And so they become a bigger part in the book, and they're still a minor role, but they're kind of a bigger minor role. And sometimes with those characters, I'll kind of tuck them away and then bring them back later. The plan would be to bring them back later in the series, and maybe they'll actually have an arc in a future book. But it's hard. I sometimes fall in love with those minor characters, and it's really hard to just let them go. But of course, you have to, or else you would end up with, by the time you got to book 8 or 9, you would have thousands of characters.
You thought about the question, it went hand in hand with Barbara's question about the Garda, and are they all over Ireland? So that you know, somebody you've seen in West Cork, for instance,
right.
Now they're in Dublin.
Yes, that's right. So there's one police officer who does also end up in Dublin with Maggie. And so, we'll definitely probably see more of him. And there are, some of her friends have various relationships and connections with some of the other detectives and guards who she's met in the other books. So, they may come back, they may come in and out of the books. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask a question before we get off this whole topic, which is why Long Island in the first place? I mean, you could have picked anywhere in America, but it seems to me that Long Island is about as close as you can get to Ireland. Before the travel time, is seriously cut down. It would be a much more difficult thing if she were like in Scottsdale, and it's a very long flight. So did you pick Long Island for its proximity to Ireland, or did you pick Long Island for some other reason?
So I picked Long Island because I grew up in the town that was the model for what I call Alexandria, but is essentially the town I grew up in. And the story always was centered there for me because the town that I grew up in was it had a very strong and proud Irish American cultural heritage. I mean, just really, really strong. It was a really big, big part of our town's community life. And I was always fascinated by those sort of the links between Irish immigrant communities, very Irish American communities, and Ireland. And when I lived in Ireland, there's learning and education for me, because the way that Irish history and Irish politics had been presented to me as part of this sort of Irish cultural heritage in my hometown was very different from how Irish people saw themselves. And so that, I think that dissonance was really interesting to me. And I really wanted to explore that. And so in The Mountains Wild, Maggie has that experience when she shows up in Ireland and she realizes that she's gotten a lot of things wrong. She's misunderstood a lot about Irish history and politics, and that's part of her education there. So it was a very personal decision to set it in that town.
Okay, thank you. I mean, but also it works out well in terms of the plots, if you're going to have them crisscrossing, from the U.S. to Ireland, which could have been the way. I'm trying to remember, Lisa, you'll probably remember the name of the woman. She was in Minnesota, and she wrote, do you remember several really good Irish mysteries involving an archaeologist, and there were bogs involved?
Erin Hart. I love her books.
Right.
She's just wonderful and just a lovely person too.
Well, she always, she never quite made up her mind whether she was going to stay in Ireland or stay in the United States. So there was a bit of a tick-tock going on. And I wondered if you were going to do the same thing. Did you wonder that too, Lisa, whether they were actually going to end up in Ireland?
I had the feeling, even when I read the first book, that Maggie would end up back in Ireland eventually. The first book doesn't end that way.
No.
And that's no spoiler. But she has such a love of Ireland.
Yeah.
And yes, Long Island was home, but I've only been to Ireland once, and I'm not Irish, but I've always said it's the home of my heart. I loved it. It never did anything to change my feelings when I went. And it seemed to me Maggie felt the same way.
Yep.
That, yes, her uncle and the pub and everything are there in Long Island, but there's a lot she loves in Ireland. And I thought she would eventually end up back in Ireland.
Yeah. And I also, I loved the idea of giving her, without spoiling anything, giving her a fresh start after the events of the first book or two. And I really liked the idea of sort of playing with this idea of going back and forth across the Atlantic, that for Maggie, a new start, a fresh start is in the place that her ancestors left and came to America, and I love that idea of sort of playing with that, the direction across the Atlantic. And I think Ireland very much is for her a new start and a place to kind of heal.
But you could see in this book, and again, no spoilers, at the end when her daughter Lily says, I miss Uncle Danny and I miss Thanksgiving.
Yep. At
home, that there will be, some sort of return. Yeah. So you knew that was going to happen eventually anyways. No, whether or not it was going to be part of the plot, I didn't know, but you knew they were going to be going back sometime.
Yeah. And I also, I think whether or not, they probably will go back, but whether or not they do, I think that's what it is to be an immigrant as Maggie is, and to be living in a place that's not the place of your birth, no matter how happy you are, and I love the Thanksgiving detail was actually very personal because, the first Thanksgiving that I was living in Ireland, I didn't even think about it. And then on the day I talked to my family and they were doing our traditional family celebration. And I just remember this sense of loneliness and loss. And one of my roommates was so sweet. She went all over Dublin trying to find me a can of cranberry sauce to make me feel, to give me a little taste of home on Thanksgiving. She wasn't successful, but she found something like cranberry jam or something. And we had that. But I wanted to show Maggie having that sense too of just no matter how much you love the new place, you do feel homesick.
My niece did her junior year abroad in England, and my sister and brother-in-law went over at Thanksgiving. And my brother-in-law is the cook in the family, and he was determined that she was going to have an American Thanksgiving, yeah, even though she was going to school over in England at the time. He didn't, like you said, didn't quite find everything he wanted for her. But those holidays, as you said, are important to people who are living there. It's what they, long for.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So Portobello, the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
It's essential to the setting of the book. It's mm-hmm. where Maggie is patrolling as a Garda. Mm-hmm. And I know you did some research on the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about the setting, the neighborhood, and the kind of research you did.
Yeah, so I knew when I started writing this book, I knew that I wanted to set it in a Dublin neighborhood that would give me a few different things. There were sort of a few things that I wanted. I wanted a mix of old and new. I wanted a neighborhood that was changing, that had some, some older residential houses and then some newer ones as well, and kind of had some arts activity and some design studios and some recording studios as that neighborhood does. And when I decided that the victim, and again, this isn't giving too much away because it happens very quickly in the book, the victim in this book is a young woman who has been trying to make a career as a model. And I was really interested in, in sort of what that, it's not something that I knew a lot about before I wrote this book. And so as I sort of started exploring, I said to some friends who live in Dublin, where would the modeling agency be? Where would, give me a sense, and where would this business be? And more and more, I just kind of kept coming back to that that Portobello neighborhood, right on the canal, and with this just, you know, this real sense of a place in transition. It's, you know, it's gentrifying very quickly. It has wonderful history, as it was the Portobello was where the it was kind of the center of Jewish life in Dublin in the 19th century. And in fact, in James Joyce's Ulysses, Leopold, it's where Leopold Bloom is supposed to have been born. And he mentions an address that actually exists as the house where he was born. And so there's just all this wonderful history there, and then this new layer of, you know, of arts and design and music and fancy coffee shops and new, you know, newly constructed apartments, and that all just kind of worked for my story. So I spent, you know, I spent quite a lot of time really just in the neighborhood, you know, going out, eating, walking around, talking to people, taking a lot of photographs and videos, and just, you know, really kind of steeping myself in it, so that when I got home and sat down to write about it, it was, you know, it felt present to me.
And in that changing neighborhood, again, this is part of the theme of the book without, you know, it's so tempting to say things that I shouldn't. but talk about the teenagers and what happens to teenagers and young people in that kind of neighborhood.
Yeah, so I really, you know, it was a friend said something to me about how, you know, how, and I think this is probably true of many cities, but she was talking about Dublin, and she was talking about how, you know, kids that you would think when a neighborhood becomes more prosperous, that kids would be, you know, kids might be safer, you know, whatever that means. And she was saying that, in fact, in her experience, it was kind of the opposite, because there had been, in the neighborhood she was talking about, there had been just this real sense of everybody looking out for everybody, and every parent was looking out for the kids who weren't their own, and there were just people there and people on the streets. And she was sort of commenting how, you know, during the day now in a lot of the, you know, inner city neighborhoods, there's nobody there because everybody's at work, and so kids are coming home alone and spending more time on their own. And I thought that was a really interesting observation, and I had some characters in mind, some vulnerable kids, and I wanted to play with that a little bit, and sort of how, you know, what was happening to these kids who were, who were just very, very vulnerable, and were, you know, weren't finding a lot of adults who were, you know, looking for them out the window to make sure they got home okay.
Maggie tends to take everything personally. And she even thinks of her cousin at points in this case. But with the vulnerable teens, although it's never expressed, I'm wondering how much she's thinking about Lily, her daughter.
Mm. Yeah, she's at this interesting point in parenting where her daughter is in her last year of schooling before she goes off to university, and she doesn't need Maggie as much. You know, in some of the earlier books, Lily is really struggling and having a tough time, but now she's settled in Dublin and she's doing pretty well, and it's exactly what Maggie wants, right? But also, Lily doesn't need her as much. And so I think Maggie in this book is really feeling kind of the what it is to have a child, you know, start to launch. And it's what you want, but it's hard to give up that role. And so in a way, these kids in the neighborhood almost become the place where Maggie can kind of put all of that anxiety and concern and worry and some of that nurturing energy that, you know, that her daughter in many ways doesn't need from her anymore. And so I thought that was kind of a fun way to explore that, this stage of her life.
And I think she's looking at other families, mm-hmm. and thinking about what she has herself.
Yep. Yep.
And the contrast.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. She's, her family is complicated.
And there's a lot of complicated families in this book. Yes. I'm trying to think where I wanted to go. Without any spoilers.
Any spoilers, it's hard. Yeah, I mean, the victim's family is very complicated.
Yes.
What's the actual incident that sets off the investigation? You could safely tell us what actually happens there.
Let's see. Yeah, I mean, so I can give the initial crime that gets Maggie involved. So Maggie and her partner, whose name is Jason, they're in uniform. They're, you know, walking the streets. And they are called to a possible domestic violence situation. Someone's heard screaming, and they go to the apartment, and a woman answers the door and says, "Oh no, everything's fine. It was just the TV. I was listening to a movie." And so they walk away. And a couple of days later, they're called back to the same apartment. And this time the woman is dead. And Maggie very quickly realizes that she had a toddler who appears to be missing. And that sort of, you know, that begins a desperate search for this child. And of course, at the same time for the killer, because the assumption is that they're one and the same. And so Maggie, you know, Maggie is a beat cop, but because her friend Rolly Byrne, who's a homicide investigator, is shorthanded, he asks her to kind of come on and help with the case. And so she's able to get involved, and she knows the neighborhood. So she has some skills and some knowledge that other people don't have. So that's how it starts. And then it goes on from there.
time frames in your book. And I know you just turned in the fifth book, and I shouldn't say that. Is it the fifth in this series, or is it another book?
So I'm working on the fifth Maggie, but I did turn in another book that's part of a different series. So that and I don't have a lot to say about that yet, but I will at some point, hopefully soon.
Okay.
But I'm working on the fifth Maggie right now. I'm very excited.
The reason I wondered about time frame is because of the fact that you did start the first one in Long Island. She's now in Dublin, but there was an entire year in between the last book and this book while she went to school.
Yep.
So I just wondered if the next Maggie is going to pick up immediately after, or if there's going to be another jump in time.
So the next Maggie takes place about 6 weeks after the events of A Stolen Child. So pretty quick. And you know, she's working as a homicide investigator, as a GARDA now. And so she's getting cases that, you know, much, much more quickly than before, shall we say.
I know you did a lot of research with the police over there as well. Would this normally happen? Is it this a, that an American police officer would go through school and eventually become a GARDA and eventually move into being a detective?
So it's a great question. And I have a couple of retired guards who have been really helpful to me and have answered all of my questions. And one of the first things I asked was, how could I get an American investigator to be working in Ireland? Like, does that ever happen? How would I do that? And I discovered that there is one American police officer who I have found who married an Irish woman and moved to Ireland. And by essentially doing what Maggie did, by going back to the academy and doing the training, he was able to work as a guard in Ireland. So it's happened at least once. What happens more frequently is that, you know, with Ireland's history of immigration, there are many Irish citizens who, you know, who may have been born in Ireland, but went to the States or went to Canada when they were, you know, one or two, and essentially grew up in North America and then returned to Ireland. And so there are a lot of people like that who, you know, who may have trained with another police force and then are coming back and doing the supplemental training or the training that they have to do. So it's, you know, it's not a regular thing. And Maggie's path I may have abbreviated certain elements of Maggie's path just for expediency in the series, but it is something that happens once in a while.
Okay, we know there is a missing toddler. Mm-hmm. There's a murder. I'm not going to ask about either of those. Can you say anything about the mystery in Maggie's house?
Yes. So, this book has a very intense sort of primary mystery and crime. It's very, you know, it's absolutely urgent that they find this child. And so everybody is just like going at, you know, 150 miles an hour, pretty much this whole book. And I like to play with pacing sometimes. And I wanted to give Maggie a sort of more low stakes mystery as a bit of a breather from from the primary mystery. And so in the house that that she and her boyfriend and their children share, they're getting ready to sell it because it's more house than Maggie and Connor need once the kids go off to university. And as part of kind of sprucing it up to sell it, the contractor finds some old photographs in the wall of Maggie's house. And her daughter Lily gets very interested in who the woman in these photographs is and how these photographs ended up in the wall. And so sort of throughout the book, that mystery is kind of running parallel to the primary mystery. And I had fun kind of researching the history of these neighborhoods and, you know, kind of coming up with that mystery as well. It was fun.
Yeah, isn't part of the problem though that Jason, is that the name of, I'm trying to remember, I think it's Jason. He's divorced his wife or is divorcing his wife. And so she has a stake in the house. So yes. Yeah, that's so a common problem. Yeah. In a divorce, the family home, many times, unless one partner can bring up enough money to buy out the other partner, the home gets sold. Or the new family doesn't really want to live in the, you know, structure of the old family. So the house is not necessarily going to be their house. It may be a house that they're going to sell. And meantime, they're looking for a place of their own. So that's a not unusual thread, I think, to have going on.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. Connor's ex-wife, you know, she is asking when are you going to sell the house, and they feel this pressure. And so yeah, you're absolutely right. That's why they're selling. But it's bringing up all of these questions about their future, of course, and that, you know, as it does when you.
Well, it's pretty gutsy for her to move to Ireland to live with somebody that, you know, there is no actual marriage commitment on the table at this point. You know, that's a lot to you know, go through retraining and join a new organization and, you know, bring your child and all the rest of it, and, you know, without any real formal agreements. But theirs is a pretty intense relationship. And there's got to be a lot of trust involved for both of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. But yeah, you'll have to keep reading to see where that all goes and whether
I'm hoping there'll be more books so we can find out where it all goes. Lisa and I are both enthusiastic. This is book 4. And, you know, a good series, I think. I don't know, Lisa, what you would think, but I think a good series ought to run to at least 7 books.
I think so. And, you know, there's 2 different series I think of when I read this one. And the reason I asked about story arc is because I thought of Louise Penny's Inspector Gamache, you know, and, you know, I read the first one when it came out, and we didn't always see the story arc coming, and it went for quite a while, you know, before she had the climax of the first story arc in that series.
Yeah.
The second one I think of is the Bill Slider Inspector, Bill Slider Mysteries, and it's because of the personal relationships in that series.
I love those books. Aren't they wonderful? Cynthia Hurd Eagles is a very underrated author. And do you know she has a new historical out that I'm considering using? We have a new historical paperback fiction club because so much historical publishing is now in the large paperback form. And anyway, I ordered it because we have a UK distributor, and it's more or less a Downton Abbey story. But when I got to the end of it, I could hardly wait to have her write. And fortunately, there's a teaser chapter, so I know there's going to be a second book. But, you know, I got so involved with the characters that I really wanted to see how it goes. And I think Cynthia Hurd Eagles is a real genius.
She is great. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I, as you said, I think she's not as well known as she should be. And those Bill Slider books are funny, and the relationships on his police team, but also his changing relationship in the course of the series.
Yeah.
You know, are just so well done.
They are. Plus, she's a genius plotter. I mean, she has some really astonishing, you know, puzzles in terms of the investigation. So I'm not sure that all of the Bill Sliders are even available in print. I'm going to have to look that up. She's now writing some for Severn House, but she doesn't have a consistent history, and that makes it difficult.
I'll admit I bought the first 3, and the next 3, they were done. Amazon had them as omnibuses, and it was the only way I could find the first 3. I mean, the library system where I worked didn't have them, you know, because they were older, you know, but they had omnibuses of the first 3 books and then the next 3 in the series. And that's how I read them.
Well, if any of you watching it who have not read the Bill Slider Mysteries, and her name is Cynthia Harrod, Harrod, and then Eagles, and she uses her double last name. I really urge you to go and find them in whatever form you can, if you're at all interested in, they're British and amazing. I'm excited about this new, because it's not a mystery, you know, it's more. And didn't she write something called The Moreland Dynasty? Didn't that go on forever?
Yes.
So she's very good at these kind of British, you know, sagas down generations of family and so forth. So this is a new family she's starting out with. And I think it's Edwardian. I just finished it, I'm pretty sure it's Edwardian. So it really is a kind of Downton Abbey or upstairs, downstairs, you know, timeframe. But yay. Sorry, giving another author a plug. Since Lisa brought it up, I couldn't.
It's good to recommend.
really what it was is we were talking about series, and I wanted to say those are the two that I think of when I read Sarah's books.
Yeah.
You know, so I hope you take that as a compliment on both series.
Both of those writers are people who I feel lucky to be mentioned in the same sentence with. I love Sarah. I'm such a series person, and there's something about that, about being able to explore that, you know, big arc of somebody's life over multiple years, that I just find so satisfying. And I like that idea of like a discrete mystery in each book, and then these right. bigger stories that kind of overlap, and that you keep going. And it's just, as a writer, it's a really fun way to explore character.
It is. And, you know, Lisa's pointing out, it's a really long story arc, and you can have a long story arc, and then you can pick it up and have another long story arc if you go on with the series. We did the book launch for Riley Sager Monday night, and I was really interested because Riley, under a different name, wrote a series for three or four books that he said never went anywhere. And then he somehow came up with the idea for, I can't remember the name of his first book as Riley. Anyway, now he's only writing standalones, which he really likes. But the question came up for the audience, is the reason I brought this up. And because somebody asked him about whether he was ever going to repeat any of the characters in the books. And his answer was basically no. But then I asked the audience, I said, it was a huge audience. There were like 200 people there. And I said, so how many of you like to read series? And it was like six hands. They were, I attribute a lot of this to the whole Gone Girl thing, in the sense that, if you have unreliable narrators and wildly twisty plots and all, you can't really do that all that well in a series. There's nothing to bind you there. And if you've tortured your characters to that degree, one book, it's hard to come back and
bring them back and then just
have all over again.
Breakfast table, right?
I was really interested in that because I love series. I tend to grab it. I mean, I'm happy with standalones, but I really love the long character arc. So I was kind of shocked. Like, really?
It's different pleasures for me. I mean, I love a big twisty thriller that I can take to the lake and sit and just, I can't put it down. And I like, that's a great feeling. And to me, getting the next book in a beloved series is just, there's something about that experience where I've been waiting and waiting and I finally get it. And right. I know what I'm doing for the next 24 hours.
Well, I'd like to think that, readers like Lisa and me are versatile enough that we can read series and we can also read standalones. And, so I'm averaging three books a day, it kind of comes out one way or another. But anyway, I really have loved your series, Sarah. And I'm excited to know you're working on a fifth one in the Maggie Darcy series. So Jacob, since we're going to run out of time and I actually have a 7 o'clock event at the store I have to get to, pop in and tell us whether we have any questions or anything. Now we wait for the dissolve. There it is. Yay.
Yeah, we do have some questions here from Facebook. Catherine Olson says, love this series. How has it been received in Ireland?
Good question. So, I've shared it with friends and the people who have helped me, the people who have been part of my research process. But we have not sold the Irish UK rights yet. So it has not been published in Ireland. And I'm hoping that changes. I really, I really would love for this series to be available there. So we'll see what happens. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that something pans out there. But it's interesting. I was terrified about how it would be received. I think my fear about that really stopped me from writing The Mountains Wild for a long time. And so it's been wonderful to have people say, I liked it. It felt familiar. You got this right. I think that's been one of my favorite parts of this whole experience?
I didn't get to ask that question. And there are people who have questions, so I won't. But I was going to ask you about the author's fear of reviews, because that's in the book.
Yes, yes, there's a whole subplot.
Lisa, she lives for them.
Connor, Maggie's boyfriend, I don't think it gives too much away to say that he's publishing a book and he's waiting for the pre-pub trade reviews. And I just, I wanted him to be really anxious about something. And I tapped into that anxiety, and it was kind of fun. I have to say, I really enjoyed it actually. And I know a number of writer friends have said to me, I love that. I love that part of the book.
Never read your Amazon reviews is the moral. Really, yes. Right. I fell for him, but then I also thought he should have had more sense.
Yes, he should have.
Right, there we go. All right, Jacob, next.
Renee asks, do you have a home in Ireland or do you rent a place when you go to Ireland?
I don't have a home. I wish I did. But I'm very lucky that I have some good friends who I can usually stay with, in Dublin. And then I'll often rent, a place or, do Airbnb when I'm out, when I'm out driving around the country. There's so many amazing Airbnb options now in Ireland. It's really terrific. It makes it easy to travel. But yeah, in Dublin, I usually stay with friends, and I'm very, very lucky to have some homes away from home there.
Okay, Beryl asks, you live in a sheep and blueberry farm in Vermont. How did that come about, and how much work do you do as a farmer?
Good question. So the way it came about is that I married a guy who had grown up on a farm in Vermont, and settled here, and we at various times in our married life and parenting life, we've had different amounts of animals. When our kids were little, we had fewer animals. And I probably about 7 years ago, we'd always had sheep that we pastured in the summer, but we didn't overwinter them. And probably about 7 years ago, I decided I wanted to start breeding sheep. And so we started lambing, and now every April we have a very intense month of lambing where I'm, pretty much all the time involved with doing chores and taking care of the sheep. But then the nice thing about sheep is that once you're through that very intensive time, and except for a few sort of points where there's a lot of husbandry around, parasite control and their feet and things like that. Mostly they're out on pasture, and they kind of take care of themselves. So it depends on the time of year, but we have chores we do every day. But for April, it's all of my time. I don't get much writing done in April, but the rest of the year, it's probably an hour or two a day that we spend doing farm work. And we don't, obviously my husband and I both have other jobs, so it's not our primary source of income. So we're not, we're not as big as we could be.
Renee also asks, do your characters speak to you?
Yes, absolutely. Maggie, every new book, I start with Maggie's voice in my head, partly because this is I sort of have, for better or for worse, have settled on first person narration. And so the first scene of every book is I'm in Maggie's head, and it's her voice that I'm using to write. And then, other characters I find, once I really get into writing dialogue, that's when, and I kind of hear the specific rhythms of different characters' voices, that's when they kind of start to speak to me. And that's fun, you know, that's fun when that happens.
There's one more. Sarah, will you be going back to Ireland this summer? If so, how long do you plan to stay?
I'm not going this summer, but I probably will be going this fall. And it depends on a lot of things. It sort of depends on how much time I can take away from the home front. I definitely I don't go for less than 2 weeks, because it just is, it sort of doesn't give me enough time to really settle in and really, get around enough of the country. But I usually will be doing very intensive research for the book I'm currently working on. And then I'll be doing research, sort of what I think of as like soft research for future books. So I'll be sort of scouting locations for future books and see if I can kind of get the creative juices flowing a little bit to suggest characters and plot and settings. And then kind of once I've settled on something, I'll go and do more in-depth research. But generally, 3 weeks is wonderful if I can do it. But it's hard. I have kids who are still at home and a lot going on the home front, and my husband's very understanding, but 3 weeks might be pushing it sometimes.
Is that it, Jacob?
That's it.
Well, Lisa, let me ask you a question. Yes. We're all used to you as a librarian and killer reviewer. What are your plans?
I'm retiring at the end of August. Moving
from
the library. I have told everybody who asked, because I had people panic on my blog who thought I was quitting, and I said I'm quitting my day job that I've done for 50 years. I started in libraries when I was 16. So I said I am going to continue blogging for the Poison Pen as long as you'll have me. I'm going to continue my blog, and I will be continuing, reviewing with Library Journal. They've changed policies in the last couple years. They no longer have people put the library they're affiliated with underneath. And I know other retired librarians who are reviewing for them.
Good. I was really worried we'd lose your voice because you are a major mystery reviewer. And, journal, but I can say that we can suck up quite a lot of your time.
And you may have it because
That'll be great because the store needs more voices. It's mostly me, and I think it would be wonderful if you have more time. We haven't wanted to impose on you any more than we already have because you have a professional position and all. But it'd be really lovely to be able to have more of Lisa's participation, I think. Basically booksellers we're all influencers, right? Yep. Lisa's an influencer and, we're not TikTok influencers. I can't dance. I could, but it's not the way I feel about selling books. But anyway, it'd be great to have Lisa's voice more involved and the Poison Pen. So I'm excited about that. Sarah, it's been lovely to see you. Thank you very much for another great book. And I will look forward to whatever from you comes next. So great. Thank you all for joining us. And a reminder that we do have autographed copies of A Stolen Child. And again, the first three are available in paperback. So it's not a huge commitment to, buy three and read the fourth. It's a lot different if this were book 11, but it's not. So got a chance. Anyway, enjoy your evening, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Thank you
so much, Barbara. And thank you, Lisa.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.